after due consideration, they will either approve one or both or neither.
TransCanada applies to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in another step toward a gas pipeline. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 23rd of April. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, Mat-Su Borough officials weigh the pros and cons of stimulus dollars.
This money ain't free.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
TransCanada today took the formal step of requesting status with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. The request represents a major step toward building a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to North American markets. The formal opening of the pre-file review will begin in about 10 days. TransCanada's Tony Palmer, who ushered the company's bid for the state license through the legislature last year, says this puts TransCanada ahead of the AGIA timetable that was agreed upon with the state.
It's the first formal step with FERC for TransCanada, but I want to assure you and your listeners that TransCanada will continue to focus on cost, schedule, and attracting customers, and the next step is to conclude our open season by the end of July of 2010.
The pre-file FERC review will trigger the presentation of engineering, environmental, and other supporting documents. Tamara Young-Allen with FERC says this process opens the project up for public review.
The pre-filing process is a great procedure to use because it gets the public, other federal agencies, state agencies, and local agencies involved very early in the process so that all those stakeholders can potentially have some influence on the final application that is ultimately submitted to the commission.
In pre-filing the project, Palmer says TransCanada comes alongside the industry-owned Denali project for initial review before the Federal Commission.
They will consider both applications and they will make a decision on those applications after we've each made a formal filing. Ours would be in 2012, and Denali will describe when their date would be. After due consideration, they will either approve one or both or neither.
Palmer says with the formal filing in 2012, the commission's work and the information provided by the companies becomes much more detailed and comprehensive. Democrats in Congress continued their push today of an energy bill that would cut down on greenhouse gas emissions and develop renewable energy. The House Energy and Commerce Committee will wrap up 4 days of hearings tomorrow on draft legislation that would set up a cap-and-trade system on carbon emissions. Today, it heard from the head of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association and took testimony on the impact of on consumers and about carbon capture and storage. Yesterday, President Obama's cabinet members testified before the committee. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu threw his weight behind the draft legislation.
For decades, our energy strategy has been little or no strategy at all. For our transportation needs, we have become increasingly addicted to oil at escalating costs to our economy, our environment, our security.
The draft legislation would reduce greenhouse gases 20% by 2020 and more than 80% by mid-century. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Lisa Jackson, says she believes it will help transform the economy.
It reflects the president's priorities of reducing our dependence on oil, creating millions of new jobs by leveraging America's tremendous capacity for innovation and significantly reducing greenhouse gas pollution. This administration wants to see this effort move forward, and I pledge to work with this committee over the weeks ahead to help you find consensus.
However, consensus will be hard to reach, especially when it comes to cap and trade, which many Republicans are against. The Energy Committee's top Republican, Joe Barton of Texas, said he does not believe humans are causing climate change, and he criticized setting up a carbon cap, which he called a carbon tax.
The people that global warming is religion believe that carbon dioxide, CO2, which is naturally occurring in nature, is the devil's brew. And they apparently think that we can only achieve salvation by putting our faith in the United States federal government. Our government will offer indulgences in the form of emission permits, and we will all atone for our past sins and our economy's past sins by paying through the nose with these expensive new energy carbon taxes.
The EPA released a preliminary assessment Tuesday of the proposed cap-and-trade system that showed it would have a modest effect on consumers if revenue generated from the pollution credits is rolled back to America's pockets. The report also backed up what EPA head Lisa Jackson told the committee, that the draft legislation would drive an energy transformation of the U.S. economy. The House Energy Committee will wrap up its hearings tomorrow when it hears about energy efficiency, the carbon market, and from former Vice President Al Gore. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Indigenous people gathered in Anchorage call for change.
The third world cannot continue, cannot afford to continue to subsidize the first world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change continued today in Anchorage as the group moves toward tomorrow's release of a declaration and action plan. Today, the United Nations General Assembly President, Reverend Miguel Díaz-Cotto Brockman, spoke to a packed room of international representatives, many in full regalia. Díaz-Cotto Brockman said the UN has worked to elevate the rights of Indigenous people worldwide through its permanent forum on Indigenous issues and the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People in 2006. He says the world is beginning to recognize the importance of traditional knowledge in mitigation of climate change because Indigenous people are the first to feel the effects.
The Indigenous peoples of the Arctic witness the unprecedented thawing of permafrost and the melting of their glaciers 30 years ago, even before the world was aware of climate change.
Díaz-Cotto Brockman said it is a bitter irony that those who contribute the least feel the greatest impacts, but he says Native peoples are resilient and have gained substantial knowledge and experience in the process.
They also have contributed significantly in keeping carbon under the ground as a result of their struggle to stop devastating oil, gas, and mineral exploitation. They save the carbon in the trees because of their fights against loggers and deforesters.
He called for ensuring that rights of Indigenous people as laid out in the UN Declaration be respected and implemented.
This includes respecting the right of Indigenous peoples to have their free, prior, and informed consent obtained before any climate change-related project is brought into their communities.
He also called for full Indigenous participation in implementing and evaluating climate change policies and programs. He says it's time for clarity on the relationship between industrial nations and developing ones.
You know, those who are subsidized by the third world project themselves as benefactors, and the ones who subsidize them are made to look almost like beggars. So this is the time, this 21st century, to call a spade a spade.
Díaz-Cotto Brockman said a meeting in June of all 192 UN member states will address the global economic and financial crisis and its impact on development. He says he hopes the discussions will bring about needed change.
And for rethinking our relationships with Mother Earth, including our sustainable patterns of production and consumption. I believe that we need, and most people want, healthy societies that are not driven by hyper-consumerism or the obsessive accumulation of wealth and dominance over others.
The Escoto Brockman said the world needs a reorientation in the direction of social and ecological solidarity. There's more questions than answers about the stimulus money that may or may not come Alaska's way. Tuesday in Wasilla, representatives from dozens of Matanuska-Susitna Borough nonprofit service agencies met to hear more from officials about tapping directly into the federal government's vein of dollars. APRN's Ellen Lockyer was there.
It was an informal and informative meeting sponsored by the Foraka Group and by the Matsu Health Foundation. Those who came chowed down on free pizza, but they were all ears when it came to finding out more about how to get government grants. Larry Persley, who's a staffer for House Finance Co-Chair Representative Mike Hawker, says it's a waiting game to see what Governor Palin and her line-item veto pen will do about some stimulus funds she's not sure about.
After lawmakers send the bill to the governor, she has 20 days, not counting Sundays, to make her decision on the budget. So I think this session, the legislature is going to get the bill to the governor very quickly because everyone's waiting for decisions on the stimulus money. What should the school district do? What should the city do? So she has 20 days, not counting Sunday. If she vetoes anything, the legislature could call itself back in special session and by a three-quarter combined vote of the House and Senate, 45 members, override any vetoes.
The legislature passed a bill on the eve of adjournment Sunday, spending stimulus money the governor has not approved yet. But Persley says there is a second stream of stimulus money that does not pass through the state and is available directly from the federal government to nonprofits and other agencies. Many nonprofits, already short on staff, will have to find their way through the thicket of federal regulations to get to it, though.
This money ain't free.
Dave Hansen is the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's Economic Development Director.
And you have to work, and you have to work very hard. Even though Congress put these deadlines and said, get this money out, they didn't change the rules any federal agency had on granting money.
He says each federal agency has its own grant process, and anyone applying for federal stimulus money directly will have to go through complicated hoops to compete. Hansen says Matsu has an 11.3 unemployment rate, which qualifies the borough as a distressed area. The borough has already applied for funds for an agricultural development center, a green water treatment center, and a wetlands program. Matsu Health Foundation's Elizabeth Ripley says some nonprofits are in a position to successfully win federal grants, and it's worth the extra time and administrative work to get one.
The more dollars we can bring into this borough, the economic benefit and turnaround of those dollars impacts all of us here in the borough. And so, and ultimately, from the Health Foundation's perspective and research shows, one of the biggest keys to a person's health is having a good job and an income. And so that economic piece is integral to creating a healthy community.
And the direct route to the stimulus money holds potential for Alaska Native tribes, too. Jennifer Harrison with Chickaloon Village says it can be difficult for Native entities to apply for state pass-through grants.
We've seen a lot of state agencies ask for a sovereignty waiver, whereas the federal agency that gave them the funding did not ask for a sovereignty waiver from the tribes. It's something that the state adds on, and that's not something that we're willing to sign, and so we've been, we've had that door that we can't, get to that funding that the feds originally gave to the state.
Sovereignty waivers essentially efface a tribe's governmental authority. The Denali Commission and the state legislature teamed up to make the application process easier for Alaska entities through the new Alaska Clearinghouse, accessible through a link on the Denali Commission's website. The Foraka Group, which advocates for and advises nonprofits, has released guidelines for nonprofits that wish to pursue stimulus grants. Any organization that applies must have a proven success rate and be able to sustain a proposed project long-term. Forming partnerships enhances the chances of getting a grant, and most importantly, don't embark on a special project now just to get grant money. It may cause more harm than good. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
With some notable exceptions, the overall overall economy of Southeast Alaska may have improved in the last year. In a recent presentation to the Sitka Economic Development Association, Juneau economist Eric McDowell said that the national economic downturn has kept more people living and working in Southeast. From KCAW in Sitka, Robert Woolsey reports.
During a period of overall economic decline, just holding your own might be considered good news. McDowell said that the population of Southeast Alaska was up this year, 0.3%. Tongue firmly in cheek, he told Sitkins at the community's new Performing Arts Center, "We're booming."
Take a look at this. We're not declining anymore as a region. That's good news. Stability. One of the reasons might be that with the economy going to hell everywhere else, there's no place to go, so we're sticking it out here. And population trends in Alaska tend to be counter to what's happening on the West Coast. If things are okay in Alaska and really booming in California, we lose population. If things are not so good in Alaska, but they're worse in Washington, we gain population. But in any event, it looks like this long-term thing has come to a halt.
The long-term thing is a decades-long slide in population that has eroded the underpinnings of the Southeast economy and marginalized it politically. McDowell said that the trend had other curious reversals, too.
It used to be that the smaller communities and the more remote areas of the region lost first, but you've had some losses, and Juneau's lost the most, and Ketchikan as well. And so... Who's losing has changed from a couple of years ago.
McDowell said that region-wide employment was up in most sectors, along with population. Through 2008, the retail and service industries were showing more employment. The leisure and hospitality industry was up. The seafood processing industry showed a slight decline in employment. He pointed to commercial fishing as a bright spot. Sitka is the 10th largest fishing port in the country by value. Over the last 5 years, the price paid to fishermen for salmon, halibut, and cod has doubled on average. McDowell said last year's financial crisis hurt the market for premium fish, but it looked like the conscientious household consumer was going to make up the difference.
The current sales are slower than last summer. When the banking crisis hit, lines of credit shriveled up, so major buyers for Sitka-based seafood just couldn't buy as much in advance, and so they're making us hold the inventory, and then when they get a few bucks out of the bank, then they can continue buying. Also, because we have premium fish, the premium tablecloth market declined some, but people are buying more for their homes.
The cruise and charter fishing industries were a different story. McDowell said that this year's anticipated 221,000 cruise visitors in Sitka was the lowest since 2001. He said Sitka remains a secondary cruise market and subject to dramatic changes when one or two ships change itineraries. The downturn forecast for expensive cruise bookings to Alaska's interior was not significantly reducing demand for Southeast cruises. Nationwide, McDowell said sport fishing was declining, with new lodges and boats in the industry more likely to suffer than established businesses. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A fire broke out yesterday in the Alaska Marine Line's office trailer in Cake. Cake Fire Chief Hank Copsey reports that the electrical fire burned the trailer's roof and apparently destroyed a nearby container van. While no one was injured in the blaze, Copsey said it could have been catastrophic.
Well, it's kind of freaky because we were right next to, I think, like a 1,000-gallon tank of propane. And then just down the street from that, less than probably 200 yards, is our Cake Triple fuel station. See, they have, I think, 60,000 gallons of gas, diesel. And then across the street from that is also our power plant, and they've got like 20,000 gallons of diesel fuel there. And then across the street at the cold storage, we have explosive ammonia. When the call first came in, I was already thinking about evacuating people to at least like a 2-mile square radius.
Copsey predicts they will have to replace the trailer, but suspects barge service will not be affected for the community of 500 people 90 miles south of Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
In Anchorage, Acting Mayor Matt Klayman commemorated Earth Day yesterday by announcing the municipality would use a federal stimulus grant to reduce the city's energy costs. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Anchorage's Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant comes from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, a.k.a. the federal stimulus package. Included in the Recovery and Reinvestment Act is $2.8 billion for state, municipal, and tribal energy projects across the country. Acting Mayor Matt Klayman announced the amount of the grant and the impact on future city operating budgets.
In Anchorage, we're going to receive $2.7 million in direct formula funding from the Department of Energy. For every Recovery Act dollar we spend on these projects, we will save $3 to $5 over the project's lifespan.
The administration estimates the nearly $2.7 million in energy and heating improvement projects will result in slightly more than $7.5 million in eventual savings. Klayman made his Earth Day announcement in front of Anchorage's Center for the Performing Arts, a vantage point from which he could point out two major targets for energy retrofits.
The first is going to be a complete retrofit of lighting in city-operated parking garages and parking lots. And this includes the JCPenney parking garage over here. It also includes the parking garage next to the bus stop. It's going to make these parking facilities brighter, safer, and more energy efficient.
For those interested in cost-saving specifics, the acting mayor offered the following.
By investing $500,000 in these parking facilities, including both parking lots and parking garages, we will save over $1.3 million in lower energy bills over the life of the installation.
And for those, in the spirit of Earth Day, who might wonder about the environmental impacts of the parking garage's retrofits,
the reduction of 7,900 metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions in a single year. That's taking about 1,400 cars off the road per year with those kinds of savings.
Other projects include lighting efficiency changes in major public facilities such as the Egan Center and the Lusac Library, LED street and trail lighting to augment the street lighting project already underway, and a heating and insulation retrofit at the Central Transfer Station where energy bills can reach $20,000 a month. Klayman says the city's energy projects also fit into the economic recovery aspect of the stimulus grant.
One of the best parts about it is that the components for all these projects are almost all made in the United States, and the people that will be installing them and working on the projects are all right here in Anchorage. So this is all good for the American economy and good for the Anchorage economy.
Some of the block grant money will help fund the salaries of current city workers, but a major portion will go to local contracting firms. Exact employment numbers were not available, other than an administration estimate of dozens of professional and skilled workers. While a street lighting changeover is already underway, the other projects will be undertaken over the next 16 months as the block grant monies arrive. Altogether, there were some 21 recipients in Alaska, including the State Energy Office. Other cities besides Anchorage are Bethel, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Palmer, Sitka, and Wasilla. Boroughs included are Aleutians East, Denali, Fairbanks North Star, Haines, Kenai Peninsula, Ketchikan Gateway, Kodiak Island, Matanuska-Susitna, North Slope, and Northwest Arctic. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska's wildfire season is expected to be slow this summer. A spring outlook released by state and federal forecasters this week shows lower than normal fire potential. Heidi Strader with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center says indicators point to another cool, wet summer.
We're in a very weak La Nina setup, which is similar to last summer, but not as strong. So that typically lends itself to a cooler and unfortunately damper summer. We also look at snowpack, which is pretty high around most of the state this year. And the last thing that we look at is springtime weather and how the weather's been panning out so far. It's been rather cool, so we're keeping that snowpack in a little bit longer than usual.
Strader says that could make for more moisture in the ground when lightning season peaks in June. She says lightning, the primary source of backcountry fire, is very hard to predict and stresses that there is potential for some large fires if ignition factors align.
All it would take is a few days of significant drying in particular parts of the state. And there are still locations where there are a lot of dead and downed fuels. We always keep our eye on the Kenai Peninsula and the Mat-Su Valley with all the building that's been going on in recent years. And with Beetlekill Spruce, those are typically hot spots where we've got a good population. We like to make sure we keep an eye on those areas.
There have been relatively few acres burned in Alaska during the last three summers. Just over 100,000 acres were consumed last year, 649,000 acres burned in 2007, and 266,000 in 2006. The three slow fire years followed two big ones, 2004 and 2005, when fires charred a combined 11 million acres. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly has given itself more authority over the hiring and firing of the borough attorney. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
If the borough attorney is ever fired, the Assembly will now have a hand in the process. Members already have a say in hiring an attorney, which is a position appointed by the mayor and confirmed by the Assembly. On Tuesday, the Assembly amended borough code to give itself the power to approve attorney dismissals as well. Assemblyman Pete Sprague says the attorney is in the unique position amongst borough department heads in that the position works for both the Assembly and the mayor.
I really believe that the Assembly should have a place in the we do have a seat at the table in the hiring, but I think we do need one in the idea of dismissal comes up as well. I think it's very important for us to have input in that decision.
Sprague introduced the ordinance changing the code. He says it's based on the way the Fairbanks North Star Borough handles attorney dismissals.
In Fairbanks, the mayor appoints the borough attorney, the Assembly confirms, and then the mayor can dismiss with concurrence of the Assembly.
Assemblyman Bill Smith from Homer says the change eliminates what he saw as a potential conflict of interest for the attorney. Smith says when he looks at a lawyer, he usually asks himself who they work for. The answer, he says, is usually the person who has the ability to fire them.
So I think that the Assembly should have a role in the dismissal of an attorney because that allows the attorney to have to know who they're working for in that essence.
Some Assembly members have been at odds with Mayor Dave Carey over the hiring and firing of department heads since Carey took office last fall. Smith and other members made it clear that they have no issues with the work of current borough attorney Colette Thompson. However, Assemblyman Charlie Pierce of Sterling opposed the change because he felt it would diminish the mayor's power.
Certainly we have the ability to have oversight and have an opinion, but I think ultimately the decision should lie with the borough mayor as to whether a person reports directly to the mayor or not.
The eight other Assembly members voted to change the code, giving the Assembly a hand in dismissal powers. Mayor Carey and Attorney Thompson did not speak on the issue. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Homer, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Rebecca Shear in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.